This is Audible.
Recorded Books Incorporated presents an unabridged recording of Julie of the Wolves by Jean Craighead George, narrated by Christina Moore.
Part 1. Amarok, the Wolf. Miax pushed back the hood of her sealskin parka and looked at the Arctic sun. It was a yellow disk in a lime-green sky, the colors of 6 o'clock in the evening, and the time when the wolves awoke. Quietly, she put down her cooking pot and crept to the top of a dome-shaped frost heave, one of the many earth buckles that rise and fall in the crackling cold of the Arctic winter. Lying on her stomach, she looked across a vast lawn of grass and moss and focused her attention on the wolves she had come upon 2 sleeps ago. They were wagging their tails as they awoke and saw each other. Her hands trembled and her heartbeat quickened, for she was frightened, not so much of the wolves, who were shy and many harpoon shots away, but because of her desperate predicament. Miax was lost. She had been lost without food for many sleeps on the north slope of Alaska. The barren slope stretches for 300 miles from the Brooks Range to the Arctic Ocean, and for more than 800 miles from the Chukchi to the Beaufort Sea. No roads cross it. Ponds and lakes freckle its immensity. Winds scream across it, and the view in every direction is exactly the same. Somewhere in this cosmos was Miax, and the very life in her body, its spark and warmth, depended upon these wolves for survival. And she wasn't so sure they would help. Miax stared hard at the regal black wolf, hoping to catch his eye. She must somehow tell him that she was starving and ask him for food. This could be done, she knew, for her father, an Eskimo hunter, had done so. One year he had camped near a wolf den while on a hunt. When a month had passed and her father had seen no game, he told the leader of the wolves that he was hungry and needed food. The next night, the wolf called him from far away, and her father went to him and found a freshly killed caribou. Unfortunately, Miax's father never explained to her how he had told the wolf of his needs, and not long afterward he paddled his kayak into the Bering Sea to hunt for seal, and he never returned. She had been watching the wolves for 2 days, trying to discern which of their sounds and movements expressed goodwill and friendship. Most animals had such signals. The little Arctic ground squirrels flicked their tails sideways to notify others of their kind that they were friendly. By imitating this signal with her forefinger, Miax had lured many a squirrel to her hand. If she could discover such a gesture for the wolves, she would be able to make friends with them and share their food like a bird or a fox. Propped on her elbows with her chin in her fists, she stared at the black wolf, trying to catch his eye. She had chosen him because he was much larger than the others, and because he walked like her father, Capuchin, with his head high and his chest out. The black wolf also possessed wisdom, she had observed. The pack looked to him when the wind carried strange scents, or the birds cried nervously. If he was alarmed, they were alarmed. If he was calm, they were calm. Long minutes passed, and the black wolf didn't look at her. He had ignored her since she first came upon them 2 sleeps ago. True, she moved slowly and quietly so as not to alarm him, yet she did wish he would see the kindness in her eyes. Many animals could tell the difference between hostile hunters and friendly people by merely looking at them. But the big black wolf wouldn't even glance her way. A bird stretched in the grass. The wolf looked at it. A flower twisted in the wind. He glanced at that. Then the breeze rippled the wolverine ruff on Miax's parka, and it glistened in the light. He did not look at that. She waited. Patience with the ways of nature had been instilled in her by her father, and so she knew better than to move or shout. Yet she must get food or die. Her hands shook slightly, and she swallowed hard to keep calm. Miax was a classic Eskimo beauty, small of bone and delicately wired with strong muscles. Her face was pearl round, and her nose was flat. Her black eyes, which slanted gracefully, were moist and sparkling. Like the beautifully formed polar bears and foxes of the north, she was slightly short-limbed. The frigid environment of the Arctic has sculptured life into compact shapes. Unlike the long-limbed, long-bodied animals of the south that are cooled by dispensing heat on extended surfaces, all live things in the Arctic tend toward compactness, to conserve heat. The length of her limbs and the beauty of her face were of no use to Miax as she lay on the lichen-speckled frost heave in the midst of the bleak tundra. Her stomach ached, and the royal black wolf was carefully ignoring her. "Amarok, Ilea, wolf, my friend," she finally called. "Look at me. Look at me." She spoke half in Eskimo and half in English, as if the instincts of her father and the science of the Gusaks, the white-faced, might evoke some magical combination that would help her get her message through to the wolf. Amarok glanced at his paw and slowly turned his head her way without lifting his eyes. He licked his shoulder. A few matted hairs sprang apart and twinkled individually. Then his eyes sped to each of the three adult wolves that made up his pack, and finally to the five pups who were sleeping in a fuzzy mass near the den entrance. The great wolf's eyes softened at the sight of the little wolves, then quickly hardened into brittle yellow jewels as he scanned the flat tundra. Not a tree grew anywhere to break the monotony of the gold-green plain, for the soils of the tundra are permanently frozen. Only moss, grass, lichens, and a few hardy flowers take root in the thin upper layer that thaws briefly in summer. Nor do many species of animals live in this rigorous land, but those creatures that do dwell here exist in bountiful numbers. Amarok watched a large cloud of Lapland longspurs wheel up into the sky, then alight in the grasses. Swarms of crane flies, one of the few insects that can survive the cold, darkened the tips of the mosses. Birds wheeled, turned, and called. Thousands sprang up from the ground like leaves in a wind. The wolf's ears cupped forward and tuned in on some distant message from the tundra. Miax tensed and listened too. Did he hear some brewing storm? Some approaching enemy? Apparently not. His ears relaxed, and he rolled to his side. She sighed, glanced at the vaulting sky, and was painfully aware of her predicament. Here she was, watching wolves. She, Miax, daughter of Capuchin, adopted child of Martha, citizen of the United States, pupil at the Bureau of Indian Affairs School in Barrow, Alaska, and 13-year-old wife of the boy Daniel. She shivered at the thought of Daniel, for it was he who had driven her to this fate. She had run away from him exactly 7 sleeps ago, and because of this, she had one more title by Gusak standards, the child divorcee. The wolf rolled to his belly. "Amarok," she whispered, "I'm lost, and the sun won't set for a month. There's no North Star to guide me." Amarok didn't stir. "And there are no berry bushes here to bend under the polar wind and point to the south. nor are there any birds I can follow." She looked up. "Here the birds are buntings and longspurs. They don't fly to the sea twice a day like the puffins and sandpipers that my father followed." The wolf groomed his chest with his tongue. "I never dreamed I could get lost, Amarok," she went on, talking out loud to ease her fear. "At home on Nunavak Island, where I was born, the plants and birds pointed the way for wanderers. I thought they did so everywhere. And so, great black Amarok, I'm without a compass." It had been a frightening moment when 2 days ago she realized that the tundra was an ocean of grass on which she was circling around and around. Now, as that fear overcame her again, she closed her eyes. When she opened them, her heart skipped excitedly. Amarok was looking at her. "Eli!" she called and scrambled to her feet. The wolf arched his neck and narrowed his eyes. He pressed his ears forward. She waved. He drew back his lips and showed his teeth. Frightened by what seemed a snarl, she lay down again. When she was flat on her stomach, Amarok flattened his ears and wagged his tail once. Then he tossed his head and looked away. Discouraged, she wriggled backward down the frost heave and arrived at her camp feet first. The heave was between herself and the wolf pack, and so she relaxed, stood up, and took stock of her home. It was a simple affair, for she had not been able to carry much when she ran away. She took just those things she would need for the journey: a backpack, food for a week or so, needles to mend clothes, matches, her sleeping skin and ground cloth to go under it, 2 knives, and a pot. She had intended to walk to Point Hope. There she would meet the North Star, the ship that brings supplies from the States to the towns on the Arctic Ocean in August, when the ice pack breaks up. The ship could always use dishwashers or laundresses, she had heard, and so she would work her way to San Francisco, where Amy, her pen pal, lived. At the end of every letter, Amy always wrote, "When are you coming to San Francisco?" 7 days ago, she had been on her way. On her way to the glittering white postcard city that sat on a hill among trees, those enormous plants she had never seen. She had been on her way to see the television and carpeting in Amy's school, the glass buildings, traffic lights, and stores full of fruits. On her way to the harbor that never froze, and the Golden Gate Bridge. But primarily she was on her way to be rid of Daniel, her terrifying husband. She kicked the sod at the thought of her marriage. Then, shaking her head to forget, she surveyed her camp. It was nice. Upon discovering the wolves, she had settled down to live near them in the hope of sharing their food until the sun set and the stars came out to guide her. She had built a house of sod, like the summer homes of the old Eskimos. Each brick had been cut with her ulo, the half-moon-shaped woman's knife, so versatile it can trim a baby's hair, slice a tough bear, or chip an iceberg. Her house wasn't well built, for she had never made one before, but it was cozy inside. She had windproofed it by sealing the sod bricks with mud from the pond at her door, and she had made it beautiful by spreading her caribou ground cloth on the floor. On this she had placed her sleeping skin, a moose-hide bag lined with soft white rabbit skins. Next to her bed, she had built a low table of sod on which to put her clothes when she slept. To decorate the house, she had made 3 flowers of bird feathers and stuck them in the top of the table. Then she had built a fireplace outdoors and placed her pot beside it. The pot was empty, for she hadn't even found a lemming to eat. Last winter, when she had walked to school in Barrow, these mice-like rodents were so numerous they ran out from under her feet wherever she stepped. There were thousands and thousands of them until December, when they suddenly vanished. Her teacher said that the lemmings had a chemical similar to antifreeze in their blood that kept them active all winter, when other little mammals were hibernating. "They eat grass and multiply all winter," Mrs. Franklin had said in her sing-song voice. "When there are too many, they grow nervous at the sight of each other. Somehow, this shoots too much antifreeze into their bloodstreams, and it begins to poison them. They become restless, then crazy. They run in a frenzy until they die." Of this phenomenon, Miax's father had simply said, "The hour of the lemming is over for 4 years." Unfortunately for Miax, the hour of the animals that prey on the lemmings was also over. The white fox, the snowy owl, the weasel, the jaeger, and the siskin had virtually disappeared. They had no food to eat and bore few or no young. Those that lived preyed on each other. With the passing of the lemmings, however, the grasses had grown high again, and the hour of the caribou was upon the land. Healthy, fat caribou cows gave birth to many calves. The caribou population increased, and this, in turn, increased the number of wolves who prey on the caribou. The abundance of the big deer of the north did Miax no good, for she hadn't brought a gun on her trip. It had never occurred to her that she wouldn't reach Point Hope before her food ran out. A dull pain seized her stomach. She pulled blades of grass from their sheaths and ate the sweet ends. They weren't very satisfying, so she picked a handful of caribou moss, a lichen. If the deer could survive in winter on this food, why not she? She munched, decided the plant might taste better if cooked, and went to the pond for water. As she dipped her pot in, she thought about Amarok. Why had he bared his teeth at her? Because she was young, and he knew she couldn't hurt him? No, she said to herself. It was because he was speaking to her. He had told her to lie down. She had even understood and obeyed him. He had talked to her, not with his voice, but with his ears, eyes, and lips, and he had even commended her with a wag of his tail. She dropped her pot, scrambled up the frost heave, and stretched out on her stomach. "Amarok," she called softly, "I understand what you said. Can you understand me? I'm hungry. Very, very hungry. Please bring me some meat." The great wolf didn't look her way, and she began to doubt her reasoning. After all, flattened ears and a tail wag were scarcely a conversation. She dropped her forehead against the lichens and rethought what had gone between them. "Then why did I lie down?" she asked, lifting her head and looking at Amarok. "Why did I?" she called to the yawning wolves. Not one turned her way. Amarok got to his feet, and as he slowly arose, he seemed to fill the sky and blot out the sun. He was enormous. He could swallow her without even chewing. "But he won't," she reminded herself. "Wolves don't eat people. That's Gusak talk. Capuchin said wolves are gentle brothers." The black puppy was looking at her and wagging his tail. Hopefully, Miax held out a pleading hand to him. His tail wagged harder. The mother rushed to him and stood above him sternly. When he licked her cheek apologetically, she pulled back her lips from her fine white teeth. They flashed as she smiled and forgave her cub. "But don't let it happen again," said Miax sarcastically, mimicking her own elders. The mother walked toward Amarok. "I should call you Martha after my stepmother," Miax whispered. "But you're much too beautiful. I'll call you Silver instead. Silver moved in a halo of light, for the sun sparkled on the guard hairs that grew out over the dense underfur, and she seemed to glow. The reprimanded pup snapped at a crane fly and shook himself. Bits of lichen and grass spun off his fur. He reeled unsteadily, took a wider stance, and looked down at his sleeping sister. With a yap, he jumped on her and rolled her to her feet. She whined. He barked and picked up a bone. When he was sure she was watching, he ran down the slope with it. The sister tagged after him. He stopped, and she grabbed the bone, too. She pulled, he pulled, then he pulled and she yanked. Miax couldn't help laughing. The puppies played with bones like Eskimo children played with leather ropes. "I understand that," she said to the pups. "That's tug-of-war. Now, how do you say, 'I'm hungry'?" Amarok was pacing restlessly along the crest of the frost heave, as if something were about to happen. His eyes shot to Silver, then to the gray wolf Miax had named Nails. These glances seemed to be a summons, for Silver and Nails glided to him, spanked the ground with their forepaws, and bit him gently under the chin. He wagged his tail furiously and took Silver's slender nose in his mouth. She crouched before him, licked his cheek, and lovingly bit his lower jaw. Amarok's tail flashed high as her mouthing charged him with vitality. He nosed her affectionately. Unlike the fox, who met his mate only in the breeding season, Amarok lived with his mate all year. Next, Nails took Amarok's jaw in his mouth, and the leader bit the top of his nose. A third adult, a small male, came slinking up. He got down on his belly before Amarok, rolled trembling to his back, and wriggled. "Hello, Jello," Miax whispered, for he reminded her of the quivering gussak dessert her mother-in-law made. She had seen the wolves mouth Amarok's chin twice before, and so she concluded that it was a ceremony, a sort of hail to the chief. He must indeed be their leader, for he was clearly the wealthy wolf. That is, wealthy as she had known the meaning of the word on Nunavak Island. There, the old Eskimo hunters she had known in her childhood thought the riches of life were intelligence, fearlessness, and love. A man with these gifts was rich, and was a great spirit, who was admired in the same way that the Gussaks admired a man with money and goods. The three adults paid tribute to Amarok until he was almost smothered with love. Then he bayed a wild note that sounded like the wind on the frozen sea. With that, the others sat around him, the puppies scattered between them. Jello hunched forward, and Silver shot a fierce glance at him. Intimidated, Jello pulled his ears together and back. He drew himself down until he looked smaller than ever. Amarok wailed again, stretching his neck until his head was high above the others. They gazed at him affectionately, and it was plain to see that he was their great spirit, a royal leader who held his group together with love and wisdom. Any fear Miax had of the wolves was dispelled by their affection for each other. They were friendly animals, and so devoted to Amarok that she needed only to be accepted by him to be accepted by all. She even knew how to achieve this. Bite him under the chin. But how was she going to do that? She studied the pups, hoping they had a simpler way of expressing their love for him. The black puppy approached the leader, sat, then lay down and wagged his tail vigorously. He gazed up at Amarok in pure adoration, and the royal eyes softened. "Well, that's what I'm doing," Miax thought. She called to Amarok. "I'm lying down gazing at you too, but you don't look at me that way." When all the puppies were wagging his praises, Amarok yipped, hit a high note, and crooned. As his voice rose and fell, the other adults sang out, and the puppies yipped and bounced. The song ended abruptly. Amarok arose and trotted swiftly down the slope. Nails followed, and behind him ran Silver, then Jello. But Jello didn't run far. Silver turned and looked him straight in the eye. She pressed her ears forward aggressively and lifted her tail. With that, Jello went back to the puppies, and the three sped away like dark birds. Neax hunched forward on her elbows, the better to see and learn. She now knew how to be a good puppy, pay tribute to the leader, and even to be a leader by biting others on the top of the nose. She also knew how to tell Jello to babysit. If only she had big ears and a tail, she could lecture and talk to them all. Flapping her hands on her head for ears, she flattened her fingers to make friends, pulled them together and back to express fear, and shot them forward to display her aggression and dominance. Then she folded her arms and studied the puppies again. The black one greeted Jello by tackling his feet. Another jumped on his tail, and before he could discipline either, all five were upon him. He rolled and tumbled with them for almost an hour. Then he ran down the slope, turned, and stopped. The pursuing pups plowed into him, tumbled, fell, and lay still. During a minute of surprised recovery, there was no action. Then the black pup flashed his tail like a semaphore signal, and they all jumped on Jello again. Miax rolled over and laughed aloud. "That's funny. They're really like kids." When she looked back, Jello's tongue was hanging from his mouth and his sides were heaving. Four of the puppies had collapsed at his feet and were asleep. Jello flopped down too, but the black pup still looked around. He wasn't the least bit tired. Miax watched him, for there was something special about him. He ran to the top of the den and barked. The smallest pup, whom Miax called Sister, lifted her head, saw her favorite brother in action, and struggling to her feet, followed him devotedly. While they romped, Jello took the opportunity to rest behind a clump of sedge, a moisture-loving plant of the tundra. But hardly was he settled before a pup tracked him to his hideout and pounced on him. Jello narrowed his eyes, pressed his ears forward, and showed his teeth. "I know what you're saying," she called to him. "You're saying, lie down." The puppy lay down, and Miax got on all fours and looked for the nearest pup to speak to. It was Sister. She whined, and when Sister turned around, she narrowed her eyes and showed her white teeth. Obediently, Sister lay down. "I'm talking wolf! I'm talking wolf!" Miax clapped, and tossing her head like a pup, crawled in a happy circle. As she was coming back, she saw all five puppies sitting in a row, watching her, their heads cocked in curiosity. Boldly, the black pup came toward her, his fat backside swinging as he trotted to the bottom of her frost heave and barked. "You are very fearless and very smart," she said. "Now I know why you're special. You're wealthy and the leader of the puppies. There's no doubt what you'll grow up to be. So I'll name you after my father, Capuchin, and I'll call you Capu for short." Capu wrinkled his brow and turned an ear to tune in more acutely on her voice. "You don't understand, do you?" Hardly had she spoken than his tail went up, his mouth opened slightly, and he fairly grinned. "Eli," she gasped, "you do understand. And that scares me." She perched on her heels. Jello whined an undulating note, and Kapu turned back to the den. Miax imitated the call to come home. Kapu looked back over his shoulder in surprise. She giggled. He wagged his tail and jumped on Jello. She clapped her hands and settled down to watch this language of jumps and tumbles, elated that she was at last breaking the wolf code. After a long time, she decided they weren't talking, but roughhousing, and so she started home. Later, she changed her mind. Roughhousing was very important to wolves. It occupied almost the entire night for the pups. "Eli, okay," she said. "I'll learn to roughhouse. Maybe then you'll accept me and feed me." She pranced, jumped, and whimpered. She growled, snarled, and rolled. But nobody came to roughhouse. Sliding back to her camp, she heard the grass swish and looked up to see Amarok and his hunters sweep around her frost heave and stop about 5 feet away. She could smell the sweet scent of their fur. The hairs on her neck rose, and her eyes widened. Amarok's ears went forward aggressively, and she remembered that wide eyes meant fear to him. It wasn't good to show him she was afraid. Animals attacked the fearful. She tried to narrow them, but remembered that wasn't right either. Narrowed eyes were mean. In desperation, she recalled that Kapu had moved forward when challenged. She pranced right up to Amarok. Her heart beat furiously as she grunt whined the sound of the puppy begging adoringly for attention. Then she got down on her belly and gazed at him with fondness. The great wolf backed up and avoided her eyes. She had said something wrong, perhaps even offended him. Some slight gesture that meant nothing to her had apparently meant something to the wolf. His ears shot forward angrily, and it seemed all was lost. She wanted to get up and run, but she gathered her courage and pranced closer to him. Swiftly, she patted him under the chin. The signal went off. It sped through his body and triggered emotions of love. Amarok's ears flattened, and his tail wagged in friendship. He couldn't react in any other way to the chin pat, for the roots of this signal lay deep in wolf history. It was inherited from generations and generations of leaders before him. As his eyes softened, the sweet odor of ambrosia arose from the gland on the top of his tail, and she was drenched lightly in wolf scent. Miax was one of the pack. All through the sunny night, she waited for Amarok to come home with food for her and the pups. When at last she saw him on the horizon, she got down on all fours and crawled to her lookout. He carried no food. "Aie!" she cried. "The pups must be nursing. That's why there's no meat." Slumping back on her heels, she thought about this. Then she thought again. "You can't be nursing," she said to Kapu, and plunked her hands on her hips. "Silver growls when you suckle and drives you away." Kapu twisted his ears at the sound of her voice. "Okay," she called to him. "Where are you getting the food that makes you so fat?" He ignored her, concentrating on Silver and Nails, who were coming slowly home from the hunt. Miax went back to her pot and stuffed on the cold raw moss until her stomach felt full, if not satisfied. Then she crawled into her cozy home in the hope that sleep would soothe her hunger. She smoothed the silver hairs of her beautiful wedding parka, then carefully took it off and rolled it up. Placing it and her fur pants in a bag made of whale bladder, she tied it securely so that no moisture would dampen her clothes while she slept. This she had learned in childhood, and it was one of the old Eskimo ways that she liked, perhaps the only one. She had never violated it, even in the warm, gas-heated house in Barrow, for damp clothes could mean death in the Arctic. When her outer garments were put away, she took off the bright red tights her mother-in-law had bought for her at the American store in Barrow. Walking to the pond, she rinsed them and laid them in the sun. The cool air struck her naked body. She shivered and was glad that she had done one thing right. She had worn her winter clothes, not her light summer kuspuk, the woman's dress. The wind gusted. Miak scrambled through the low door and slid into her sleeping skin. The silken softness of the rabbit fur embraced her, and she pulled the hood around her face so that only her nose was exposed. The fur captured her warm breath, held it against her face, and she became her own radiant stove. In this cozy micro-world she forgot her hunger, and recalled what she already knew about wolves, so that she could put it together with what she had observed. "Wolves are shy," Capuchin had said, "and they desert their dens if discovered by man." Yet this pack hadn't. Did Amarok not know she was human? Perhaps not. She had never walked in his presence, the two-legged signal of man to wild animals. On the other hand, he must know. Capuchin had said that with one sniff, a wolf knew if you were male or female, adult or child, if you were hunting or not hunting, even if you were happy or sad. She concluded that Amarok tolerated her because she was young, had no gun, and was sad, a lost child. She next considered Nails. Who was he? Amarok's dependable friend, that was true, yet she suspected he was even more than that, a spiritual father of the pups. Nails took orders from Amarok, but stayed close to Silver and the little wolves. He was father when their real father was busy. He was Amarok's serious partner. But Jello, who was he? Where had he come from? Was he a pup of a previous year? Or had he joined the pack just as she had, by soliciting Amarok for membership in his tribe? There was much to learn about her family. Miax didn't know how long she slept, for midnight was almost as bright as noon, and it was difficult to judge the passing of time. It didn't matter, however. Time in the Arctic was the rhythm of life. The wolf pups were barking their excited yip-oo that rang out the hour of the end of the hunt. The pack was coming home. With visions of caribou stew in her head, she got out of her sleeping skin and reached for her clothes. The puppies may not have been eating, but certainly Amarok would have to bring Jello some food. He had been home all night. Stepping into the sunlight, she put on her tights, danced a moment, and then pulled on her furs. Leaning over the pond, she saw in the glassy water the hollows of her cheeks. She was pleased, for she looked almost like the Gussak girls in the magazines and movies, thin and gaunt, not moon-faced like an Eskimo. Her hair! She leaned closer to the tundra looking-glass. Her hair was a mess. Pressing it into place with her hands, she wished she had taken Daniel's wedding brush and comb with her. They lay unused in the corner of a table drawer in the house at Barrow. Quickly she climbed the frost heave, lay down, and looked at the wolves. There was no meat to be seen. The three hunters were stretched out on their sides, their bellies extended with food. Jello was gone. "Of course," she said to herself, "he had been relieved of his duties and had backtracked the hunters to the kill." She winced, for she had been so certain that today she would eat. "So I won't," she said to herself, "and that's that." Miax knew when to stop dreaming and be practical. She slid down the heave, brushed off her parka, and faced the tundra. The plants around the pond had edible seeds, as did all of the many grasses. There were thousands of crane fly and mosquito larvae in the water, and the wildflowers were filling, if not very nourishing. But they were all small and took time to gather. She looked around for something bigger. Her black eyes were alert as several Lapland longspurs darted overhead. They might still have young in their nests. Staying on one side of the heave, so the wolves wouldn't see her two-leggedness, she skipped into the grass. The birds vanished. Their dark, pointed wings were erased from the sky as if they had sensed her deadly purpose. Miax crouched down. Capuchin had taught her how to hunt birds by sitting still and being patient. She crossed her feet and blended into the plants, still as a stone. Presently a grass blade trembled, and Miak saw a young bird fluttering its wings as it begged to be fed. A brown, lark-like parent winged down and stuffed its open beak. Another youngster begged, and the parent flew to it. Unfortunately, the second little bird was so far from the first that Miak knew they were out of the nest and impossible to catch. She shifted her attention to the snow buntings. A movement in the sky above the horizon caught her attention, and she recognized the pointed tail and black head of a jaeger. She knew this bird well, for it hunted the shore and tundra of Nunavak Island. A bold seabird, it resembled its close relative, the gull, but wasn't a fisher. The jaeger preyed upon lemmings, small birds, and occasionally carrion. Miax wondered what prey it was hunting. Three more jaegers joined the first, circled close together as if over a target, then dropped out of sight, below the horizon. "The wolf kill!" she fairly shouted. "They're sharing the wolf kill!" Jumping to her feet, she lined up the spot where they had disappeared with a patch of brown lichens in the distance, and ran with joy along the invisible line. When she had gone a quarter of a mile, she stopped and looked back. The endless tundra rolled around her, and she couldn't tell which frost heave was which. "Oh, no!" she cried. She turned around and laboriously searched out the plants crushed by her feet. Near a pool, she lost all sight of her steps, and then with relief recognized an empty lemming nest, a round ball of grass that she had kicked open. She pounced on it, saw a flower she had trampled, and ran up the heave to it. From the top, she looked across the distance to her own precious house. She reminded herself not to be so careless again. "One can get lost out here," she said aloud. Miax flopped down in the grass to rest. Her hand touched a patch of Arctic peas. They were tiny, but numerous. She took off her boot and then her sock, and filled its toe with the vegetables. When all were harvested, she swung the sock over her shoulder and, striding joyously, rounded her pond and plunked the peas in her pot. She rolled them around with her fingers, and they rattled musically. She rolled them again and made up words to fit their rhythm. "Peas that go tink, peas that go tot, peas that will never grow outside my pot." The puppies yapped, and Silver ran out across the tundra. She leaped with grace, her fur gleaming like metal. Then she swept into a dip in the landscape and vanished. Up from the horizon rose the jaegers, announcing that Silver had gone to the kill. Clutching the cooking pot to her breast, Miax excitedly waited to see her bring back meat for the pups. The jaegers circled. The longspurs tumbled on their wings, and at last Silver came home. Her mouth was empty. "I just don't understand," she said to the pups. "What's keeping you alive?" Putting down her pot, she went to her lookout to try to solve the riddle. Silver came up the long slope, gave the grunt whine that summoned the pups, and Kapu ran to meet her. She pulled back her lips in a smile and nosed him affectionately. Then Kapu stuck his nose in the corner of her mouth. Silver arched her back, her neck rippled, and she choked up a big mound of meat. Kapu sat upon it with a snarl. "So that's it," said Miax. "The meat's in the belly basket. Now what do I do?" Kapu let Sister share the meal with him, but not Zing, Zat, and Zit, as Miax had dubbed the three tawny pups who had little personality as yet. Zing rushed over to the resting Silver and cuddled up against her. He rammed his nose against her teats and, taking one in his mouth, ravenously nursed. Silver tolerated this for a moment, then growled. He didn't let go, and she snapped at him. He pulled away, but when she stretched out, he dove back into her belly fur again. With a loud bark, she rolled onto her stomach and cut off her milk from him. Zing got up, walked over to Amarok, and stuck his nose in the corner of his mouth. Amarok regurgitated food. The secret of the fat pups was out. They were being weaned from mother's milk to well-chewed and partially digested food. They might eat food from the belly basket for weeks before they were brought chunks of meat that Miax could share, and so she went out into the grasses again to look for buntings. Soon Silver and Nails trotted off in the direction of the kill. Having fed the puppies, they were now feeding themselves. Miax cautiously peered around the heave. Jello hadn't gone with them, yet he had been to the kill. He would have food in his belly basket. When the Jaegers arose into the air, she picked up the pot and climbed once again to the top of her frost heave. Getting to her hands and knees, she gave the grunt whine call. "Look at me. I'm nice," it said. Jello strode toward her. So pushed around was he by Silver, so respectful of Amarok and even Nails, that he was excited by a voice more humble than his own. He even lifted his tail and head higher than Miax had ever seen him do, and acting like the boss wolf, loped up her frost heave. Curious Kapu trotted behind. As Miax scurried to meet Jello, he hesitated, growled softly, and urinated. "Don't be scared," she said, and whimpered. He circled closer. Quickly rising to her knees, grunting the note of friendship, she slipped her hand over his head and clasped the top of his nose firmly in her fingers. "I'm boss," she said, as his tail and head went down in deference to the symbol of leadership. She started to slip her hand into the corner of his mouth, but he jerked away. Then Kapu, as if he understood what Miax wanted, swept up to Jello and nuzzled his mouth. Jello heaved, opened his jaws, and deposited food on the ground. "I'll live! I'll live!" Miax cried jubilantly as Jello turned, put his tail between his legs, and raced back to the other pups. Kapu sat down and watched with wrinkled forehead as she scooped the meat into the pot. When she had retrieved every morsel, she gently closed her lips on the bridge of his nose. His tail wagged respectfully, and he gazed softly into her eyes. "Kapu," she whispered, "we Eskimos have joking partners, people to have fun with, and serious partners, people to work and think with. You and I are both. We're joking serious partners." He wagged his tail excitedly and blinked. "And that's the best of all." She reached out to hug him, for his eyes were mellow and his fuzz irresistible. But he was like water and slipped through her hands. On two knees and one hand, holding the pot with the other, Miax hobbled toward her camp. Kapu bit her heel softly, and she glanced over her shoulder. His head was cocked, and his tail swished slowly. "What are you saying now?" she asked. He gave the grunt whine for attention. Of course, she was his big sister, and he wanted to play. Reaching into her pocket, she pulled out a mitten, and before she could flash it in front of his nose, he had leaped, caught it, and was pulling and shaking her whole arm and torso with incredible strength. Miax let go, lest she spill her meat, and Kapu rolled head over heels into the lichens. Taking a firm grip on the mitten, he flattened his ears in spirited fellowship, dashed down the slope and up to his den. There he turned to see if she was following. "Bring back my mitten," she called. "I need it." He flashed the wolf smile of apology, shook the mitten, and romped into the midst of his other brothers. Kapu scratched a wide swath on the ground with his hind feet. The three tawny pups sniffed the mark, and Zit sat down before it. Bold Kapu had written his signature, and it was deep and impressive. Miax wondered if the mitten victory was responsible. It was quite a trophy to win. Placing her pot by her fireplace, she walked out on the tundra and gathered dry grass and lichens in her sock, for there was, of course, no wood to burn. Although caribou droppings were a better fuel, she was too fearful of getting lost to hunt them. Piling the grass and lichens in the center of the stones, she went into her house, took a small cookie tin from her pack, and removed one precious match. Then she lit the tinder. The grass burst into flame, and the lichens smoldered slowly, giving her time to dig the peat that the dead grasses had laid down for thousands and thousands of years. Gradually the peat glowed, the water boiled, and an hour later, Miax had a pot of caribou stew. "At last," she said. On it floated great chunks of golden grease, more delicious than the butter from the Gusak store. She put a savory bite in her mouth, sucked the juices, then chewed a long time before she swallowed. She mustn't eat too fast or too much. Capuchin had said that an old lady, rescued from the snow after weeks of starvation, so stuffed herself that she died the next day. Munching another bite, she went out to the grass clump to check on buntings, and a long time later returned to eat two more chunks of caribou. The rest, though she longed for it, she stored inside her house. Then she patted her stomach and told it to wait. For the first time in days, she could think of something other than food.